From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins. Sitting in today for Tony is our own Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships for Family Research Council.
Good Monday afternoon to you. I'm Sarah Perry, your host on this, the 8th of June, 2020. On today's edition of Washington Watch, after a weekend of nationwide protests and calls for justice and reform, new demands are surfacing. A majority of the members of the Minneapolis City Council said Sunday they support disbanding the city's police department altogether. An aggressive stance that comes just as the state has launched a civil rights investigation after George Floyd's death. And last week, the mayors of Los Angeles and New York announced cuts to their police budgets as high as $150 million. What does this mean for law and order in the United States? And what of the violence, rioting, and unrest fomented by the left during the protests? I've got Chris Farrell, Director of Investigations and Research for Judicial Watch, with his thoughts. In my second and third blocks, a recent survey indicates that 80% of Americans believe the country is out of control. But this isn't the first time Americans have faced uncertainty and chaos. We've recently celebrated the 76th anniversary of D-Day, when America faced a monolithic evil and the future of freedom was uncertain. I've got David Clausen, FRC's Director of Christian Ethics and Biblical Worldview, on his recent op-ed and the American temperature. And in my last block, Vice President Mike Pence made an appearance at Hope Christian Church in Beltsville, Maryland this weekend. There, the Vice President participated in a roundtable discussion with Black faith and community leaders to discern the way forward in these divisive and uncertain times. I'll be joined by Bishop Harry Jackson, Senior Pastor of Hope Christian Church, with his thoughts on where to go next. A reminder, our website, TonyPerkins.com, is where you can find the information on today's guests and associated resources. You can follow us on social media at FRCDC and go to our podcast with any of your favorite platforms. If you haven't downloaded the Stand Firm app, make sure you do so. It's available in the Apple App Store and the Google Play Store. Make sure you've got the most updated version. We've rebuilt it, and now you can take Washington Watch with you wherever you go.
This is what political courage is for. Political courage, there are moments in every person's career where you have to stand up and be willing to say, am I willing to sacrifice everything that I have, all the privileges that I have, so that the right thing can go through? This is one of those moments. This right now is one of those moments. So if you're an elected official that for any reason is on this call, I'm asking you to ask yourself, what are you willing to sacrifice to make sure that overfunded police departments are defunded?
Well, that is, of course, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, known also as AOC, making a call to defund police by every elected official. Nationwide protests incited by the killing of George Floyd and the ensuing outrage continued to swell this weekend. Thousands demonstrated in large cities, New York, Washington, D.C., Los Angeles, and Minneapolis, where Mr. Floyd died. And around the world, tens of thousands demonstrated in support of the U.S. protests while also denouncing racism in their own countries. But in a dangerous, counterproductive, and what I would consider deeply irrational promise of reform, nine members of Minneapolis's city council, a veto-proof majority, said they are starting the process of entirely disbanding the city's police force. It would be the first example of a major city replacing its police department, presumably with something new and fundamentally different. Leading the charge against lawlessness, of course, is none other than the Southern Poverty Law Center, who is defending Antifa after Attorney General Barr's promise to classify them as a domestic terrorist organization. Joining me now to talk about all of it is Director of Investigations and Research at Judicial Watch, Chris Farrell. Chris, welcome to Washington Watch.
Sure, it's great to be with you. Thanks very much.
Well, I thought it was bad enough when we were hearing initially calls for defunding or stripping funding from some of these underfunded already police departments, but now we're hearing increasing calls to dismantle police altogether as a sign of, for example, racial injustice, racial disparity. But if you believe the city council members, This is to be opposed and not to do so is indicative of your white privilege. Talk to me about the notion of tearing these police departments apart.
It's an outrageously dangerous move. And, you know, any of these folks who are grandstanding and trying to politically benefit or motivate certain elements of society by appealing to folks on this basis should also pass a corollary or an additional portion of the law that says that they are personally and pecuniarily liable for any old damages, either to property or to persons, that they accept personal responsibility for the consequences of their actions.
Mm-hmm.
So if AOC wants to lead the charge on defunding or disestablishing police departments, then she was talking about her personal bravery and her political will to do so, then she should also accept personal responsibility and liability for any and all property damages or loss of life. She needs to carry the load on this. And anybody
yes.
else who subscribes to the same sort of lunatic fringe thinking should do the very same thing. If they want it, they should buy it and own it personally.
You know, I found it really interesting that Mayor Frey in Minneapolis, who himself has sort of been a darling of the left since the entire process began, would not outright commit to dismantling the police department and was shouted and booed out of a demonstration and a rally on Sunday. So it shows you how quickly the left-wing mob turns on its own. You know, you as a student of history and an astute mind is someone who understands that the revolution eats its own. So you eliminate the singular opportunity to maintain law and order, the individuals who've put life and livelihood on the line to defend the individuals who are out protesting. They are subsequently affected by these Antifa activists. 10, 15, 17, I think, is the total number of lives lost during the violent protests. And yet, they are continuing to argue for elimination of the police departments or defunding the police departments that have been hanging on by a very thread to maintain law and order in the country. I don't think we are at a point nationally where we are sufficiently capable of policing our own behavior. If ever there was a time to fund the police, to recruit for the police, I would think it would be now.
Correct. And you know, the folks who are going to be most at risk in this lawless society that they advocate for are going to be the elderly, the mm-hmm. very young,
yep.
and women. And the irony, of course, is these are the same people that they would so proudly claim to defend and respect and honor, and that's exactly who will be placed in the greatest danger. And like as you said, if you want to take this bad situation and make the most of it, well, then proactively recruit and broaden the base of your police department
mm-hmm.
and make it more inclusive. If that's what your concern is, well, then let's take a bad situation and make the best of it, not destroy what little exists of any sort of order.
I want to talk a little bit about some statistics here. The number of black victims of violent crime fell by two-thirds from 1993 through 2005 in conjunction, perfectly parallel with widespread adoption of larger police forces, more patrols in inner city urban areas, greater willingness to cite or arrest people for lesser offenses. In that period of time, there has been a perfect parallelism between increased police force and a decrease in victimization of violent crime. So I would think the inner city folks themselves are anxious for police presence because those who are not engaging in criminal conduct need the police presence to make sure that they're being protected themselves. When we look all the way back to the 90s in New York, their strategy of tracking crime trends, sending cops to areas where crime was spiking has worked. Liberals and conservatives for years have written about these correlating statistics, and yet we have these calls, and right at the head of the snake is the SPLC, who refuses to go along with any rhetoric indicating that there is anything to be feared or demoted or curtailed or policed when it comes to the violent actions of organizations like Antifa. In fact, they said specifically that designating Antifa as a domestic terrorist organization, regardless of the rioting, the looting, the car fires, the deaths, would disproportionately police members of the citizenry that are already being policed. It would be an infringement on civil liberties of all citizens. I don't see them standing up and saying, you know, we really have to be careful about violent crime. Really peaceful protesting is the way to go. So to what do you owe that, Chris?
Well, we all know the very sketchy background organization and history, the documented history of Southern Poverty Law Center. You know, some very strange characters and some very irregular activities on their part as an organization. And the fact that they would align themselves with this militant, you know, Operation Antifa. Antifa, you know, the irony, of course, once again, anti-fascist, they actually adopt and act out the precise techniques and tactics of the brown shirts in 1930s Germany.
Yes.
The sort of street thuggery that seeks to suppress actual real dialogue and really act on intimidation and threats. The irony is rich there. And the notion that FDLC would actively be legally advocating for them and, you know, abandoning any sort of data, any social science analysis of policing statistics, and just, you know, coming up with this concept of defund the police based on what?
Right.
Defund what activities at what percentage, according to what analysis? Be specific, and you won't get specificity. You get this sort of, you know, broad sweeping assertions that.
Well, and isn't this emblematic of the left? It's part and parcel of the revolutionary firebombing of trash the whole system and start over. Not let's take the good parts, let's modify what isn't working. Obviously, bad policing does exist in certain areas. Let's address it. Let's do a thorough audit of what the behavior is, what the training is, what the backgrounds are, what the perspectives are of our police force. No. Let's throw it all out and start over. Well, I tend to disagree, and I think Chris Farrell of Judicial Watch does as well. Thanks for sticking with us on Washington Watch. We've got unrest and uncertainty on the rise, and most Americans think their country is out of control. But in our next segment, we're going to turn back the clock 76 years and learn that these feelings of chaos and lack of control, they're not new. I'm going to talk to our Director of Christian Ethics and Biblical Worldview, David Clausen, about it right after this. Stay tuned.
As coronavirus restrictions begin to ease, many Americans are grappling with how to adapt to the changing times. The last few months have transformed how worshipers think about church and how they are fed spiritually. While many churches are conducting services through live streams, drive-in services, and other means, questions still remain. What practical steps can we take? Are current restrictions appropriate? Do these restrictions violate the Constitution or religious freedom protections? Family Research Council has a new publication discussing religious liberty issues and offering practical guidelines for how churches and houses of worship can begin to operate as our country opens back up. Visit frc.org/churchguidelines to view this resource and learn more. As always, visit frc.org/church for our full list of resources for churches in the time of coronavirus.
Masculinity in America has never been under attack the way it is today. We've reached the point where the term itself is considered toxic or offensive to many. The consistent message in our nation is that masculinity by nature is bad and is the root cause of many of the problems plaguing our society. From his experience as a military combat officer and ordained minister of the gospel, Lieutenant General William Boykin has seen and dealt with firsthand the breakdown of leadership in our nation by the lack of godly men living lives of biblical purpose. In his latest book, Man to Man, Rediscovering Masculinity in a Challenging World, he addresses the essential elements of manhood as a provider, an instructor, a defender, a battle buddy, and a chaplain, and explains how to personally develop these traits and pass them to the next generation. Get your copy today of Man to Man, wherever books are sold.
Stay informed with what's going on in our nation's capital. Make a difference in your community. And keep your friends and family up to date with Family Research Council's new and improved Stand Firm mobile app. Like never before, this new tool is bringing Christians across America together in advancing faith, family, and freedom. On the Stand Firm app, you can contact your elected officials on campaigns and policies that are important to you with the new Take Action tab. You can listen to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins live and play previous episodes on our media player while conveniently going about your day. And you can access the Washington Update, informative blogs, tweets, and critical campaigns on our main feed so you can stay up to date on local and national news. Download the Stand Firm app on your mobile browser by visiting frc.org/app. That's frc.org/app.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry sitting in with you Monday, the 8th of June, 2020. We've got unrest around the world. I have often laughed at the meme that's circulating on social media where a woman bends forward, squinting her eyes, saying, "Just waking up to see which page of the Revelation book we're currently on." There's lots going on. It's helpful to remember where we were 76 years ago. And in 1944, 160,000 soldiers had landed on a 50-mile stretch of coastline in northwest France to secure a foothold in Europe and defeat the creep of socialism around the world. And today, a recent NBC Wall Street Journal poll indicates that 8 out of 10 voters believe that things are out of control in the U.S., with a majority still concerned about the spread of the coronavirus, pessimistic about the economy, divided in its choice of leadership. And joining me now is FRC's Director of Christian Ethics and Biblical Worldview, David Clausen, who's going to help me break it down. David, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me, Sarah.
All right, so let's take sort of a jump back in time and review where we were this time back in 1944. Take us back to D-Day and why that harkens to a feeling of chaos and might give us some lessons for the future as we move forward.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, there are certainly some anniversaries, excuse me, that should never go past without us pausing and remembering. And one of those is June 6th. And like you said, 76 years ago, was D-Day, which with very much with World War II up in the air, General Eisenhower led 160,000 Allied troops landing off the coast of northwest France. And like you said, they were able to secure a foothold in Europe. And that turned to be that proved to be the turning point in the war. And I think it's hard sometimes. We're 76 years removed to wrap our minds around the significance of D-Day and what it meant. But without a victory on June 6th, who knows how World War II would have ended. And we're just, I think Saturday, which was the June 6th anniversary, is one of those days that should never go by where we don't at least pause and reflect on what it means to be Americans, what it means to be free, and what it means to just thank the greatest generation who went before us to secure those freedoms for us.
You know, it's interesting that you were talking about the greatest generation, because so much of this for me harkens to a contrast between where we were then and where we are now. Your piece cites the fact that 43% of all Americans indicate an openness to socialism as a governing philosophy. This, I'm sure, would have been anathema to all of those young men who got on U-boats to make the departure overseas and risk their lives and their livelihoods to make sure they were defending the principles of freedom. So part of me is disheartened at these numbers. We like to beat on millennials, post-millennials, Generation Zers, which I guess is our youngest cohort now. But do you think there is something to be said about the character of who we are now, or is it strictly that we have no institutional memory about what we've sacrificed in America?
Well, I think that's a big part of it. And there's polls that show that, you know, the average American couldn't pass an eighth grade civics test. And so I think we have lost our understanding of civics and history. And that statistic that I cite in the op-ed, you know, 43% of Americans do indicate some openness to socialism. And that's really, it's just hard to wrap your mind around that, especially when you think about what the greatest generation fought for. So many people today are willing to give up freedoms that our previous generation paid such a high price to protect. And, you know, I actually got to go to Normandy about 7 years ago with my family. My dad's a big World War II history buff, and he took me to Omaha Beach, and we went to the American Cemetery. And I'll never forget, Sarah, standing there looking at 9,000 American graves with those white crosses, seeing the ages of those soldiers. They're 18, 19, 20 years of age. So many soldiers that never got to go home to their families. And yet they knew what they were getting into, and it was worth the risk because they believed that our freedom and our democracy and our way of life was worth fighting for and ultimately dying for. And we can't let their sacrifice go to waste.
You know, it's interesting because C.S. Lewis, the premier theologian, I think, of his day, if not for all time, wrote an address that he delivered at Oxford back in 1939. And it was an address that was essentially geared toward existential uncertainty. We knew we were on the cusp of war, and he asked how it's possible for life to continue as usual at the university when the lives of our friends and the liberties of Europe, obviously writing as a Brit, are in the balance. And he said, war creates no absolutely new situation. It simply aggravates the human permanent situation so that we can no longer ignore it. I feel that that's a bit where we are right now socially. There's an aggravation of the human condition. I think there's probably a connectedness to our ultimate sin natures that is driven out of things like fear and selfishness and pride and arrogance. Do you feel that that's the same way?
I do, and it's amazing to listen to that speech that C.S. Lewis gave in the late 30s, and I think he is getting at something that is very applicable today. And, you know, just anyone that watched the news this weekend, there is a level of uncertainty, there's a level of unrest, there's a level of anxiety. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as a Christian, it just reminds me again that we live in a Genesis 3 world that is ravaged by the effects of sin. And that has just unfortunately just been driven home again this week. And as we're just seeing so much unrest in this country, it obviously gives Christians an opportunity to point to the hope that we have in Christ and the hope we have in the gospel. But, you know, any kind of expectation that, you know, things are all well in America and this country, you know, it's not true. It's a reminder that we live in a fallen world.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Jared Stepman just had a piece of the Daily Signal. You and I were talking about this actually before we went on the air, talking about how 1967 and 68 were among the most tumultuous in American history after civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. was killed. There have been some tumultuous eras, but when we come back, David and I are going to continue our discussion about feeling out of touch, feeling chaotic in a period of American history that does seem out of control, where we find our hope in the midst of all of it. Stay with us on Washington Watch. We'll be right back.
masculinity in America has never been under attack the way it is today. We've reached the point where the term itself is considered toxic or offensive to many. The consistent message in our nation is that masculinity by nature is bad and is the root cause of many of the problems plaguing our society. From his experience as a military combat officer and ordained minister of the gospel, Lieutenant General William Boykin has seen and dealt with firsthand the breakdown of leadership in our nation by the lack of godly men living lives of biblical purpose. In his latest book, Man to Man, Rediscovering Masculinity in a Challenging World, he addresses the essential elements of manhood as a provider, an instructor, a defender, a battle buddy, and a chaplain, and explains how to personally develop these traits and pass them to the next generation. Get your copy today of Man to Man wherever books are sold.
Stay informed with what's going on in our nation's capital. Make a difference in your community and keep your friends and family up to date with Family Research Council's new and improved Stand Firm mobile app. Like never before, this new tool is bringing Christians across America together in advancing faith, family, and freedom. On the Stand Firm app, you can contact your elected officials on campaigns and policies that are important to you with the new Take Action tab. You can listen to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins live and play previous episodes on our media player while conveniently going about your day. And you can access the Washington Update, informative blogs, tweets, and critical campaigns on our main feed so you can stay up to date on local and national news. Download the Stand Firm app on your mobile browser by visiting frc.org/app. That's frc.org/app.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. We are talking about how Americans feel as though their country is in chaos. We've cited a recent NBC poll, but let me say that the data on this came out just days before a fabulous report from the Department of Labor on Friday, in which it was revealed that 2.5 million jobs had been added in May, and the unemployment rate had not shot up to 20%, but had actually dropped to 13.3%. So I'd be curious to see, David, where these numbers would be if we could just hit a refresh button on a computer and see if accounting for an economy that is making a U-turn and seems to be turning around quicker than people thought, if it would be the same sentiment. But that having been said, let's talk a little bit about how we, you and I as Christians, how do we glean hope from what seems to be a hopeless year? You know, I've told my friends this truly is one of those years that you couldn't write into a script. It wouldn't sell as a movie because it would be too implausible to actually take place. And yet here we are. So guide us a little bit using scripture as to where we can get order in the midst of this chaos, where we can find some peace.
Yeah, it's a great question. You're right. If we were scripting this, no one could have possibly said that there'd be this, you know, worldwide pandemic and that you'd have, I think, worldwide over a million people, unfortunately, who've succumbed to this. And now, right after this, as the stay-at-home orders are being lifted, to have so much racial anxiety and the protests that we're seeing on our TV screens. But I think it is important to have some historical perspective. And again, mm-hmm. I'm not mitigating what's happening. These are very difficult times. These are troubling times. But, you know, as a nation, we have been through difficult and trying times before. The Great Depression, World War II, you referenced it earlier, the unrest of the 60s and 70s with the Civil Rights Movement, Vietnam War, Watergate, the Iran hostage crisis, 9/11. You know, so you think about it, the average adult here in this country has been through many crises. But I think that's important to have that kind of historical framework. But it is what we're going through right now, it does feel different in one way because it's affecting everybody. You know, even if you weren't laid off and you lost your job, you can't even go to the grocery store without realizing that everybody's been affected by this. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as Christians, you know, it's important for us to remember, Sarah, that even though things are in a state of flux, we should still find hope that God does not change. He's still on his throne. He's still in control. One verse I'll give you is Hebrews 13:8, which reminds us that Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. And actually, one other verse that comes to mind is Isaiah chapter 40, verse 8, where the prophet says, "The grass withers, the flower fades, but the word of our God will stand forever." Mm-hmm. And so even though we are in chaotic times, it's important for us as Christians to hold on to that hope that even though things around us are crazy and there's so much chaos, none of this took God by surprise, and he is still on his throne, and we can look to him for our hope.
You know, I used to tell my children that when things looked like they were falling apart, there may have been a reason behind it. And I find that God does nothing or permits nothing strictly because it's a whim, that he has designs. There are purposes. He can glean beauty and snatch beauty from things that the world meant for evil. And that's one of the things I've taken into my own personal life and the way that I parent my children. Look for the purpose, the messages that God's sending, but also God's order can sometimes look like chaos in disguise. And so we sit uncertain of what the future may hold. We petition the throne of grace with our prayers, but we really, at this time, could do no better than fall to our knees and ask for his guidance and his peace. If there's any a time to petition him, to enhance our relationship with him, and to increase the number of times we talk to him during the course of a day, I would think this is it.
Oh, I agree with you. And I think actually polls bear that out during the last 2 months with this coronavirus. I think it's shown that Americans are praying more. They're reading their Bible more, you know, and mm-hmm. I think that's so encouraging, as so many Americans have had to stay at home under quarantine. So many Americans are now wrestling with the big questions that we all face. And I think they are seriously grappling with these things. And just one verse to what you said, Sarah, you know, Romans 8:28, I think, is one of the most encouraging verses in the Bible. For all things, even the difficult things, mm-hmm. all things work together for good to those who love God, who are called according to his purpose. And I think that's one verse that especially now we should really cling to.
You know, we are in a position, I think, where not only are Americans feeling as though things are out of control, I've actually cited previously on this show a separate poll that indicates many Americans, most of them indeed, feel as though God is sending them a message during the pandemic, that really there is something that they themselves need to be reflective of. And so maybe this is an opportunity for us to really examine the condition of our own hearts and to see whether or not the way that we live is in alignment with God's purpose for our life, with the directions he's given us through his word, and with the promise of hope that he has given us through Christ Jesus. David, I always love talking to you. Thanks for being with me today on Washington Watch. Well, we've got some more hope coming up. We'll hear from senior pastor at Hope Christian Church, Bishop Harry Jackson. He hosted Vice President Mike Pence for a roundtable discussion this past weekend on race and reconciliation. And he's got some words to say about where he thinks we're headed next. Stick around. We'll be right back.
As coronavirus restrictions begin to ease, many Americans are grappling with how to adapt to the changing times. The last few months have transformed how worshipers think about church and how they are fed spiritually. While many churches are conducting services through live streams, drive-in services, and other means, questions still remain. What practical steps can we take? Are current restrictions appropriate? Do these restrictions violate the Constitution or religious freedom protections? Family Research Council has a new publication discussing religious liberty issues and offering practical guidelines for how churches and houses of worship can begin to operate as our country opens back up. Visit frc.org/churchguidelines to view this resource and learn more. As always, visit frc.org/church for our full list of resources for churches in the time of coronavirus.
Masculinity in America has never been under attack the way it is today. We've reached the point where the term itself is considered toxic or offensive to many. The consistent message in our nation is that masculinity by nature is bad and is the root cause of many of the problems plaguing our society. From his experience as a military combat officer and ordained minister of the gospel, Lieutenant General William Boykin has seen and dealt with firsthand the breakdown of leadership in our nation by the lack of godly men living lives of biblical purpose. In his latest book, Man to Man, Rediscovering Masculinity in a Challenging World, he addresses the essential elements of manhood as a provider, an instructor, a defender, a battle buddy, and a chaplain, and explains how to personally develop these traits and pass them to the next generation. Get your copy today of Man to Man, wherever books are sold.
Stay informed with what's going on in our nation's capital. Make a difference in your community and keep your friends and family up to date with Family Research Council's new and improved Stand Firm mobile app. Like never before, this new tool is bringing Christians across America together in advancing faith, family, and freedom. On the Stand Firm app, you can contact your elected officials on campaigns and policies that are important to you with the new Take Action tab. You can listen to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins live and play previous episodes on our media player while conveniently going about your day. And you can access the Washington Update, informative blogs, tweets, and critical campaigns on our main feed so you can stay up to date on local and national news. Download the Stand Firm app on your mobile browser by visiting frc.org/app. That's frc.org/app.
Welcome back to Washington Watch on Monday, the 8th of June, 2020. I'm Sarah Perry sitting in for Tony Perkins. As a reminder, make sure you have our Stand Firm app. You can find it in the Apple or Google App stores, or you can go to TonyPerkins.com and download it there. You can take the show wherever you go, and it is brand new and updated. Well, with racial tensions on the rise, Vice President Mike Pence made a visit to the predominantly black Hope Christian Church in Beltsville, Maryland on Friday to hear faith leaders and community members describe in personal and historic terms the racial discrimination that has led to more than a week of national protests as the event began. The vice president acknowledged the long struggle for racial equality, and he stressed that starting the healing in a house of worship was historically fitting.
It is undeniable that in the long struggle for equality in this country, people of faith have played the decisive role. And the entire quest to end slavery emanated from the churches of this country to challenge the conscience of the nation. Now, the civil rights movement that happened when I was a little boy in Columbus, Indiana, I am told by those that were involved was driven out of the pews of this nation. I had the great privilege 10 years ago, Bishop Jackson, to take my wife and children to Alabama. We walked across the Edmund Pettus Bridge, arm in arm with my friend John Lewis. But the day before, we spent time in Dr. King's church, and there we met with many of the people that marched with Dr. King, and they said that before they marched, they prayed and they sang and they had worship. And I couldn't help but feel that as our nation reels from the tragic death of George Floyd, that a place to start the conversation is in a place of worship. It's the wellspring of our nation's strength. It's been the wellspring of our national unity and our steady march toward a more perfect union.
Joining me now is senior pastor at Hope Christian Church and the host of Friday's event with Vice President Pence, Bishop Harry Jackson. Bishop, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you for having me, Sarah. Good to be with you.
I'm excited to talk to you because I have to tell you, I am desperate for hope, and I am looking for a way that we can all bring the ears to hear that the individuals who participated in Friday's roundtable discussion themselves have. So let's start from the beginning. I want to talk about the roundtable discussion itself and how it actually came to be.
Well, the discussion was, it came to be from interaction I've been having with the White House over a two-week period. From the moment that George Floyd passed, I simply discerned that there was going to be, this was not going to be like the other events.
Hmm.
So I've been attempting to give counsel and input as far as I was concerned from my faith-based vantage point. First of all, number two, I've been working on a book called A Manifesto that can be ordered on Amazon, and it has some solutions to some issues that Tony and I wrote about in our co-authored book about 15 years ago. So I've been praying about it. Good Friday, I was invited in the White House. We had a prayer declaration. Tens of millions of people saw the president make a statement, me pray from the White House. So I've been in this place of fasting and prayer literally for a couple of months now.
Hmm.
So I simply will say, I think it's time to deal with these problems. I believe the church has got to rise up and begin to interact and lead the way, because when you don't have clear moral leadership,
yes,
like you did under King's day, he did a great job of holding the Bible in one hand in the church, in the black churches specifically, Constitution in the other hand, as he went out to various cities. He did an amazing job of founding, pioneering nonviolent protests. The church has got to lead the way.
Yes.
Or in King's day, it would have been that various Muslim groups would have risen up. Violence would have overflowed even more than it did back in those days. Retaliatory violence. So we need the voice of the church. We need opportunity to talk like you're talking now. And I do think that I need white evangelicals to speak to the pain of the black community, Sarah.
Yes.
The reality is you've got multiple generational wound.
Mm-hmm.
People like my children and my relatives who have children's children that are down in preteen age, many of these people feel that white America, even Christians, just don't care. Boom. Full stop. And because of that, it makes the emotional pain. Some of the people are operating as though they are under post-traumatic stress, living their lives. Mm. The black health rates are through the roof. More cancer, more heart disease, more diabetes, et cetera.
Yes.
Because many are living under stress. Now, I'm not trying to blame anybody. Nobody white in this generation caused this problem, but they have the privilege of attempting to fix it.
Yes.
Think
yes,
about
absolutely.
That. So it's going to get worse if we do nothing, but I think we can move strategically and say, I'm not sitting around trying to take unnecessary blame, but I am going to, if I'm a white evangelical American, I am going to take some action that just affirms the basic human humanity of people and the theological doctrine of Imago Dei, that every human being
mm-hmm.
the image of God, and thus no one can take someone's life unrighteously. It's out of the will. It doesn't say thou shalt not kill exactly in the old King James. It's what it says is thou shalt not murder.
Yes.
It's a place for perhaps execution through legal means, all kinds of justice. But just to blow out the candle of life on a man in the dirty streets of a city with no compassion at all, and to act like that's okay, that's not okay. And I think that's the generational, psychological, emotional, and even spiritual pain that is reverberating around the world.
Because at what point do you stand up and say enough? And it sounds like you really knew that this was different. This was an incident that was really going to spark a sea change. And I pray that it does. And I think you're right, Bishop, that the church writ large has to lead the charge. If anyone understands the nature of unequivocal love, of love for everyone, equal love, where the foot of the cross is level ground, for whom we have a universal hope and a savior, all of us together. It has to be us leading the charge on this. So talk to me about some specific ways that the church can encourage and come alongside the Black community. You talked about acknowledging the pain. That is a huge first step. I think pretending that it doesn't exist does nothing but a disservice to those who want to help and discredits generations of pain that you referenced have been just passed on continually, that are old wounds that have not yet healed effectively. But give me some more specifics about what we can do to come alongside and elevate and assist the Black community.
Well, I think we need to call for a national prayer movement that will begin the healing. And we've repented over everything about life, about this, about other things, but I believe that the sin of racism is critical. So I would say programs like this we're doing now. I plan to do some Facebook live events where we bring people who have platform speaking directly to the community. I feel your pain. I think it starts with each one of us using our sphere of influence.
Yes.
Simply to say, I empathize, I get it, I care about you, I'm not going to let this continue to go on in our nation. That's number one. Number two, I'm so proud that the president is doing some, he's creating a new commission that deals with policing in America, and he announced it today. But I think some tangible steps like that are critical.
Yes.
But those are long-term things. So think about it this way. A revolution, and I think that this, a revolution of ideas, it started with the spoken word, maintained with the written word, and a revolution is thinking is what we need in the church. Uncle Tom's Cabin, pre-Civil War, Harriet Beecher Stowe found a Black man that lived in Maryland, and she interviewed him. He had written a story about his life. And in order that he wouldn't be attacked or lynched himself, she didn't call him by his name. She fabricated the name Uncle Tom. Mm. And so he lived in Tobacco, Maryland. She told his true story. From the moment that Uncle Tom's Cabin came off the first press run, they had pre-sold all the books. Back then, it was over 3,000 books. By the time they went over, again, thousands of thousands, every time they went to reprint, they sold them all before they finished. As a result, all the New England states sent for, I'll use the great state of Maine. Maine said, we're sending our young men. They didn't have slaves in Maine. But young white men felt that abolishing slavery was such a high priority that because they were Christians, they volunteered, and of the males, a tenth of them went to war, and a tenth of those that went to war were killed in the Civil War. Over an issue that was biblical and spiritual to them. So Harry Beecher Stowe raised up a prophetic voice, and notice it wasn't a black person, it was a white person. Notice that early 1900s, the first decade, you may not know this fact, but the NAACP was not started by black people. It was a white Christian movement that dealt with the fact that somebody in the Springfield, Illinois area said, this lynching of black people, it's got to stop.
Wow.
It's got to stop because it's wrong. They gave the money. W.B. Du Bois was a first communications director of the movement. He did not originate it. He was funded and helped to do it. The first black NAACP executive director did not come into office in 1973. What we're dealing with, if the church doesn't stand up and be the church, you are not going to see this thing change. And when we say the church, it's got to be the whole church. It can't be the black church. It can't be some ethnic church. It's got to be the church of Lord Jesus Christ.
Yes, amen.
Power.
Absolutely.
I'm sorry. I feel like I'm trying to preach to you.
No, I love it. Occupational hazard, right? Listen, we got about a minute left. Tell me, Bishop, after this roundtable discussion, did you leave encouraged? Is there more of an event like this in the future for your church specifically?
Well, for my church specifically, I helped them find a place in Minnesota for this week. For my church, yes, I talk Sunday. I'd love to have any of your folks go to Hope Connection, listen to our message. I talked about the day of Pentecost, the fact that God allowed an ethnic division in the world to be healed because of the outpouring of the Spirit. The speaking in tongues was a sign of reunification. The prophecy was a sign that the church was being born, and we were praying that we would get that same kind of unifying power from heaven, that same kind of anointing to speak to the hearts. Like right now, blacks, Hispanics, and others need someone to speak in the name of the Lord with spiritual authority.
Yes.
And first let them know, hey, everything's going to be all right for you. You're going to be able to get through this. You're going to survive. And that's number one. Then number two, really, himself is a fathering grace. I've seen him around his kids. I know he's got it. And we also...
Oh, Bishop, I wish we had an opportunity to finish, and it sounds like we lost you. But listen, the book is called A Manifesto, Hope Connection. You can watch the church online there. This has been Washington Watch. I hope you leave today with some hope. I'll be back with you tomorrow on Tuesday's edition of Washington
Watch. Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.